looking at health outcomes for wealthy U.S. citizens compared to other developed countries?
For patients that use telemedicine, are there health inequities?
What happens if you implement and then repeal a sugar-sweetened beverage tax?
And for patients who have antibodies to COVID infection, how protective are they against future infection?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And here we are still, of course, in the midst of the pandemic. So why don't we turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine? This, of course, of great interest to many people. If you have antibodies against SARS-CoV-2, are you protected?
This particular study was conducted in healthcare workers in the United Kingdom. They attempted to assess the relationship between the presence of antibodies to COVID and the risk of subsequent reinfection. They looked at over 12,500 healthcare workers who had participated in having antibodies measured, antibodies to the spike protein and antibodies to the nucleocapsid. Now, these are both IgG antibodies they assessed for. When they assessed for these antibodies, about 90% of healthcare workers did not have these antibodies present, which indicated they hadn't had previous infection, or if they did, they didn't generate much antibodies. And about 10% of them had antibodies, and they followed these individuals for up to 31 weeks. For those that had no antibodies, they developed COVID infection, as determined by PCR tests, about 1.09 per 10,000 days at risk. Those that had antibodies, only two of those, or 0.13 per 10,000 days at risk, developed infection. That's a reduction of about 90%. And by the way, for those two individuals that had antibodies and subsequently developed infection, they were asymptomatic. They just happened to be evaluated on routine testing and found a test positive. This indicates, I think very successfully, that the presence of anti-spike or anti-nucleocapsid IgG antibodies is associated with a significantly reduced risk of developing COVID infection over the next 6 months.
And that is an uplifting piece of information, if you will. Let's reflect, though, just for a minute on the fact that these folks who did develop a subsequent infection, in spite of the fact that they had antibodies, were asymptomatic. I wonder about their spreading of that to other people.
Well, Elizabeth, that's a great question. Obviously, if you're not infected, you're not going to spread it. They did not assess secondary spread after this.
Since we're talking about the UK, of course, we'd be remiss in not mentioning this UK variant that everyone is so concerned about now. What are your thoughts about that? I gather that the spike is not substantially different.
This will be the second variant we will have talked about that has a higher rate of infectivity, but no increase in severity or mortality. So I'm not terribly surprised by it. What we need to find out is whether the vaccines we're administering is effective in preventing infection.
I think we're going to have some data on that this week, on laboratory tests relative to that issue.
I'm not sure it's against all three vaccines at this particular point. I think it's something we're just going to have to deal with over the subsequent months.
Let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. This study is taking a look at the health outcomes of privileged U.S. citizens compared with average residents of other developed countries. We know that there are just huge health inequities in this country. Well, if you're a higher income person, are those health outcomes that are potentially not as good as they could be overcome by the fact that you've got more means at your disposal? I think this data is kind of old. It's from January 1st, 2013 to December 31st, 2015. In it, they identified white U.S. citizens living in the 1% and 5% highest income counties in the U.S., and they measured six health outcomes associated with healthcare interventions. And these included infant and maternal mortality, colon and breast cancer, childhood acute lymphocytic leukemia, and acute myocardial infarction. They compared the outcomes data to all residents in 12 other developed countries: Australia, Austria, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland. So lots of places with a lot of what I'm going to call socialized medicine. And these outcomes were really revelatory and I thought concerning, because regardless of how much money you have here in the US, both infant and maternal mortality are higher among white U.S. citizens versus the average person who's in these other countries. With regard to the other conditions, the data were mixed. Breast cancer was actually among the best outcomes. However, the acute lymphocytic leukemia, and especially the myocardial infarction case fatality rate, did not compare well with these other countries. So the authors suggest, hey, guess what? We think we can buy our way out of substandard or subpar health outcomes when it comes to other countries. But the fact is, that's not true.
There are some outcomes that were better in the U.S. for the, quote, privileged white compared to the average person in other countries, and outcomes that were worse. Cancer being better in the U.S. and other outcomes maybe not being quite so well or being equivalent. So you pay more and you get the same. What we pay more for is a physician to get the best care. But what we're describing here are hospital outcomes. You don't pick those processes. It's the hospital processes that often drive the outcomes in people that have acute myocardial infarction, for example, or even some types of surgery or cancer treatment. These six health outcomes is a very narrow spectrum. It looked at health outcomes in the zip codes where people lived, but people oftentimes don't receive their care there. For example, they go to specialized cancer centers or specialized heart centers. Finally, you and I both know that there are other factors associated with outcome, behavioral factors. This is interesting because we pay more for healthcare than any other developed country in the world. It looks like the outcomes may not be better always.
Clearly, there are societal factors that are impacting on this. There's our famous and much vaunted independence as Americans. Other countries do not appear to ascribe to the same degree. And that's, of course, impacting on our rates of COVID-19 as well. So I think that there's definitely that. And our notion that somehow having physician choice is going to be able to overcome all these other variables. I'd like you to comment on standardization of process. Do you feel that would have a positive impact on some of these outcomes?
There's no doubt about it, Elizabeth. When we look at things that we commonly look at, infections after surgery or infections associated with being intubated or whether people are put on the proper medications. On the one hand, not every patient's the same, but there's good evidence that there are certain things that actually improve outcomes. And making sure that those are standardized across all healthcare facilities or hospitals is incredibly important.
Let's turn to GEMMA Network Open. This is taking a look at patient characteristics associated with telemedicine access for primary and specialty ambulatory care during the pandemic.
This was a really interesting article, and I'm glad you picked this one for us to talk about. It's clear that the COVID-19 pandemic has devastated communities of color. And as the authors mentioned in their discussion, it's kind of exposed the deep inequities of our U.S. healthcare system. As a result of the pandemic, we've moved a lot of our visits to telemedicine visits, some of those via telephone and some of them via video. And we have to ask the same question. Are there inequities as well that can affect health outcomes? And that's what these authors attempted to do. The University of Pennsylvania, a very large system, did a retrospective medical review looking from March 16th to May 11th of this year of all patients who were scheduled for a telemedicine visit. How many of those actually had their visit? Was it telephone or video? They examined over almost 150,000 unique patients that had scheduled telemedicine visits. About 60% of these were women. They noted that only about a half of them actually completed their visit. Now, who were the people that were less likely to show up for their telemedicine visit? Those that were older age, Asian, non-English speaking as their first language, and those that were Medicaid. Those were the patients that were less likely. Well, if you think about it, those are the people that actually you really want to have visit. Which patients didn't do video? Again, older age, female sex, Black race, Latinx ethnicity, and lower household incomes. What drives this? Well, there are a lot of things that drive it. One is access to computer. Second is access to broadband. Third, older individuals, their familiarity with technology. As you know, Elizabeth, my mom is legally blind. She can't do telemedicine. She can't see. For those that are non-English speaking, not knowing how to navigate all this. And then finally, there's some mistrust. There are a lot of things that we're going to need to overcome because I think the new normal is that we're going to be doing a lot more telemedicine visits.
Oh, I absolutely agree because I just have borne witness to so many barriers that are reduced by employing telemedicine. I think way back to about, it's been several years ago now, to someone who was really a pioneer in the field for movement disorders and employing telemedicine in that population for whom it's just such a challenge to try to get to a healthcare center.
Essentially, most of my older individuals don't want to receive telemedicine. Now, some of us, they want to come in and see the doctor, but some of us, they just don't feel comfortable with it. inequities willing to deal with. So I think this is a terrific study. Thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Yes, of course. Of course, now we need to strategize on ways to overcome those barriers. It's interesting also to point out that the same population that's reluctant to use telemedicine is the very same population that's at the highest risk for COVID-19.
Bingo. And not only highest risk for COVID-19, but also highest risk for having severe infections when it does occur.
Okay, finally, staying in JAMA Network Open, taking a look at where beverage taxes are imposed on sugar-sweetened beverages, and lo and behold, their consumption drops, and so do lots of other outcomes like prediabetes and obesity. This study takes a look at the first time that this natural experiment has been available, which is in Cook County, Illinois. They passed a beverage tax, they implemented it, and then just a few months later, they repealed it. And they looked at sales of these beverages both before and after and said, hey, what happens when this kind of circumstance takes place? Sure enough, when they implemented the tax, the consumption went down. When they repealed it, it went right back up again. And one of the editorialists comments that the problem in Cook County was that they never educated the public about the health harms that were associated with consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages and get support for these taxes among the population. And when you contrast that with places in the U.S. where they have done all of that education, it's been much more acceptable to the population. They also say that an important thing to do is to say, hey, we're not just going to tax you more. This isn't just a sin tax, oh, you bad thing, for the same thing, alcohol and cigarettes. That if you hook those increased taxes to outcomes that are meaningful for some of these populations, like early childhood education, it becomes even more acceptable to implement this.
Elizabeth, you're right. We missed the ball on this particular one. There are people that thought that if you just put a tax in, it's going to have significant and long-lasting effects that transcend even when the tax goes away. In this particular case, they raised the price of sugar beverages by 30%, and usage went down about 28%. No big surprise, and then it went back up. But the opportunity, as you mentioned, was we didn't link it to the health consequences, and that's the major issue. And then, by the way, we're going to turn this money around to target the population that's most at risk for having these health consequences. The states that you mentioned, California, Washington, Colorado, also had similar increases in taxes, but they tied it to the health consequences. They used the income to address the problem, and they've done a much better job of decreasing the rate of sugar beverage intakes. You know, this was more a study in behavior than it was in health outcomes.
I'm interested in your speculation on something we were talking about before we started recording, which is the rather disconcerting number of people who are still reluctant to wear masks. And I'm wondering if you think any of the discernment that's in this particular study regarding difficulty changing people's behaviors could apply to that. Like, how are we going to communicate to these folks what they really need to do?
That's a great question. If you want to change behavior, you have to attach it to something meaningful to that particular person, whether that's improving their health, making them less susceptible to infection or less susceptible to transmitting to other individuals. And if you connect the dots in a meaningful way, that's when people change their behavior.
On that note, let's adopt that as our New Year's resolution. That's a look at this week's Medical Headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.